Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, new reporting from the Charlotte Observer reveals allegations of unethical behavior by former CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox and a school system vendor. Just weeks after the defeat of the sales tax referendum for the arts, the Arts and Science Council lays off some staff. I-77 toll lanes are now completely open, but other work remains, and the contractor continues to pay daily late fines. And David Tepper reveals he's not a fan of mediocrity. What that may mean for the future of the Panthers and in what is turning out to be another mediocre season. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this table are Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for WFAE News. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno is off mic, but he's a reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB TV News Rising. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Jonathan Lowe is anchor reporter for Spectrum News and the man who has great ties.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Good morning.
We're all on the radio. He's not wearing a tie today. All on the radio, but if that's not enough, you can watch us on Facebook Live. And as I mentioned, the Charlotte Observer is reporting new allegations regarding former CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox. This is a story that is exclusive to the Observer, so we've invited the Observer's education reporter to join us. Annie Maugh is here for the first time. Good to meet you. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Welcome. You and your colleague at the paper, Fred Clayson Kelly, who's been on this program, have discovered that Clayton Wilcox ordered the spending of nearly $2 million with education tech firm Think Circa. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
And a year later, he asked Think Circa if he could become their CEO. If that were all there were, if that was all there was to this story, would it be a concern about unethical behavior?
A lot of the ethics experts we talked to said that. Yesterday, the company itself came out with a statement saying that they found the behavior to be unethical and that they never had considered him for it, given the fact that they had been working in the district before. So the company has kind of taken a position against him. People who sort of watch these things have raised questions about it, and certainly people within the district did raise concerns internally and amongst themselves about what this meant. I don't know that they knew about the CEO offer, but they were concerned about how the contract came to the district.
Well, it wasn't an offer, right? It was more of a solicitation on his part or an application.
Yes.
And it sounded like he did bring that up from what you reported, which to me is stunning that, you know, that would be like one of us saying, I've got a job offer with somebody I cover. You would then be invited to leave because that's a conflict of interest.
Yes. So he, back in earlier this year, board members went to talk to him about his job performance, is what we were told by our sources. And he responded by saying, well, you know, like I could be the Think Circa CEO and leave the district.
Well, let's get to that. Let's go through this because there is more to this story than just that. And it goes back to concerns that a lot of people had. And we talked about this, I think, on the roundup many months ago, that Wilcox kind of forced CMS into buying this software, this technology, despite the fact that they already had very similar and cheaper technology in place. And a lot of people didn't want this new technology. So take us through this, Annie. What exactly happened after he took the position of superintendent and he started talking about this new technology?
Well, overall, I think it's fair to say that Wilcox was a fan of stuff for education.
Right.
He was very involved with the ed tech industry. He'd sort of been through the revolving door that is sort of the business ties between education, and this is true across districts. A couple of weeks after he came into CMS, he scheduled this meeting with senior academic officers that with the CEO of a company that, or a top executive of a company that employed his son. And that sort of was the first red flag. People were sort of questioning, why would we enter into this agreement? It just, you know, even if there's nothing wrong with it on paper, it just invites questions that the district really doesn't want to engage with. And then throughout his time in CMS, senior officials told us that they just could never understand why he was so set on this program called Think Circa. It's an online argumentative writing platform that also serves as a sort of literacy platform by having access to a lot of texts, sort of like an online textbook. And CMS had similar programs that did the literacy component, and teachers were confused, principals were confused. No one really knew why he wanted it. And it turns out that he had had a long professional relationship with the founder.
And more than a few teachers pleaded, evidently, that was the word I think you used in the story, not to buy this software. And one wrote, please don't waste taxpayer money on this. And in recent months, we've heard about these objections and what was going on. Who in the school system at the school board level was aware of this and when?
So it's a little unclear. Mary told us that Mary McRae, the school board chair, told us that she recalled Think Circa coming up in his salary negotiations, but she didn't remember the exact details of those conversations. Other people told.
And she said she was unaware of complaints lower than the superintendent level about this move to this software.
Yeah, she told us that it's hard for her as a school board chair who's not, you know, hands-on in the day-to-day operations of the district to intervene in these kinds of situations unless people go to her.
So on June 21st, 2018, which is a year and a half ago, Wilcox wrote an email to three administrators that said, quote, schools using something else to accomplish what Think Circa is designed to accomplish should stop. No polling, no debate, ramrod it, end quote. Ramrod it, end quote. Is that an unusual directive?
Yes, it is.
It's very Trumpian.
I'm trying to think what I would do if I told what would happen if I told my boss to ramrod anything. But,
yeah, but he is the boss. If he told you, if your boss told you to
ramrod the story.
It's
bad either way.
Well, and I saw teachers posting on Facebook saying this was right after he gave a big speech talking about teachers are professionals. They should have ability to make decisions. So he's saying that in the setting, and then he's giving this
P.S. ramrod.
Don't ask questions.
Could it have been that he just was tired of hearing objection because he wanted this software in there for whatever reason, whether it's because he wanted the job later on or he just thought it was better software?
Well, I can't speak to his intention because he has never called us back, but I can say that it really differs from the way that things are brought into any school district, especially one as large as CMS, is very bureaucratic. You usually do competitive bid processes. You read these like tens of pages of like arguing about amongst vendors about like which product is better. They're all trying to pitch to you. You're trying to evaluate all of these things, and usually it's lower level staff who make these recommendations. Occasionally, superintendents will be like, "I like this thing. Can you take a look at it?" But to say, like, ramrod it and to subvert that process, which CMS has a very structured process for bringing things on, was a huge departure from what was expected.
So Clayton Wilcox, who was a bright and shining star in our education world for the longest time until he wasn't, was let go earlier this year, just months after the school board extended his contract and gave him a raise. It didn't seem to make sense at the time of his departure as to why they would let him go, because it was a vote of a lack of confidence, quite clearly. But your story, Annie, seems to shed light on what prompted that vote of confidence. You've already mentioned this a little bit. In March of this year, he approached Think Circa, Wilcox did, Circa, about becoming its CEO. And then he told the school board that he might be leaving to go and be their CEO, even though they really hadn't offered him the job. Is that what precipitated his wage increase and the premature extension of his contract? They didn't want to lose him?
No, because that wage increase, the salary increase and the extension happened in January. So this conversation happened after that.
Okay.
And didn't you say it was in the context of some board members approaching him about problems? So clearly there was this apparent vote of confidence,
and
then
something
deteriorated.
So you got this information from several sources, including two district officials with knowledge of the conversations with the school board about this possible job. Why is this coming out now? Why now? Why didn't it come out months ago?
I really cannot speculate about other people's intentions, but I think like we have really aggressively asked these questions, and I think once you you know, he has left the district, it's never really been understood. The public wants to know, and we've been really aggressive about chasing that down. I think at some point people
I think you have to give the Observer huge credit for, you know, for pulling all sorts of records and for doing essentially the oversight that it kind of looks like the school board did not do, because, you know, the board chair signs off on contracts of this size, and The board chair apparently did not know there were these problems. And granted, you know, I don't know that we had anybody actively covering education in March, but that, you know, we would not know routinely, but you guys did serious due diligence.
And to your point, and it speaks to, it kind of gives more context to why they have this compliance and transparency committee now that can investigate anybody, including the superintendent.
Well, let's go back to this idea that he told the school board that I could go and be their CEO, this company's CEO. Is there something wrong, unethical, immoral, about leveraging one job against another?
I think Anne laid it out really well. There's a sort of revolving door, and this is bigger than CMS, where a lot of national education policy watchers are concerned about the way it's that business is moving into school districts, where they'll sell these shiny things and kind of profit off of taxpayer money. So I think there is that concern based on, like, the industry that was going, that he was talking about going to, and because CMS had been doing business with them before.
But when he said, I might go to another school district, that's probably pretty routine for salary negotiations.
Right.
I think the difference is I am in negotiations with a large vendor that I have sent business to. To me, that's I don't know how you don't get invited to leave at that point.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, so to raise questions brought up by another prominent investigation, let's talk about the quid pro quo possibility here. was it implied at any time, or do we know, that if Wilcox bought this technology from ThinkCirca, he would be coming to them later on for a future job?
I don't know exactly, but when we talked to the company CEO, he was very adamant that they had done business correctly. And in a lot of ways, it's true, right? Like, if you are trying to sell something to a district, of course, you're going to try to, like, get to the head honcho. And he has this quote in our story, which is that ThinkCirca did business with CMS the way that they do with all districts. You try to sell to the biggest decision maker, and it's kind of on them to say, no, no, go through us, go through our lower level staff. I don't know that they have denied any wrongdoing in that sense, and it's kind of unclear, like, what exactly happened in those internal conversations.
And according to your reporting, four former CMS administrators said this incident is an example of why they left the district after Wilcox became superintendent. Does that indicate that there are other examples yet to be uncovered of behavior that is questionable?
Well, I will let you know if I find out anything more. But I think we can look back to this first story that we did about the deal with Fuel Education, which was the company his son worked for at the time. I think when you look at these two things together, it does start to seem like they were not isolated incidents.
Well, and remember, when
also
they hired
your
him,
story.
One of the first things he did was to bring in his chief of staff
Absolutely,
from the previous
yeah.
district and then create a job for her husband that did not exist before, that was not advertised.
And chef.
Yes, and that was kind of one of those things that people raised their eyebrows and went, this doesn't quite smell
well,
right.
Well, and it, Mike, that other story, you know, the hundreds of public records requests that you want, the initial with the racial intimidation, you know, in talking to CMS people that I know, they're telling me stories of how he used to refer to himself.
Stealthy Mexican?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, that was common, apparently.
Well, the question also goes back to, we were talking earlier, people want to know what kind of vetting was done, because there were so many red flags. And as you say, the first thing coming in, creating jobs for spouses of staff he's bringing along. Mm-hmm. And that's the question.
I have 30 seconds. And in your reporting, did you go back to previous school systems that he worked for? Were there similar behavior patterns at those systems?
Yes, we looked at.
So we should have known that.
I was not here at the time, but a lot of it was publicly reported.
Okay. Andy Ma is the education reporter at the Charlotte Observer, who broke this story along with her colleague Fred Clayson Kelly about this ongoing series of potential improprieties by Clayton Wilcox, which explains his absence and departure, I suppose. We're coming back with more of the News Roundup right after this at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Joe Bruno, we've given over Annie Moth's microphone to Joe Bruno from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
The Arts and Science Council's fundraising model has cratered in recent years. We talked a lot about this before the sales tax vote. And so they came to the county with that idea to float a referendum to raise the sales tax by a quarter cent, and the money would then go to the arts, to parks, greenways, and education. The ASC would take 49% of the $50 million that increase would have brought in, about 22 point something million dollars. But the voters said no to that. So this week, the ASC cut four positions from its staff, and with it, 15% of their annual salary budget. Who did they lay off?
So they laid off the senior vice president of community engagement, the vice president of education, a position in the communications department, and a position in the finance division. But what's interesting is the head of the ASC didn't say whether these cuts would have happened if the sales tax actually passed.
That was going to be my question. Are these tied to the defeat of the referendum? I mean, you don't know.
And we don't know. And I'm not sure if this is just an attempt to, you know, make people feel guilty for voting down the tax, or if this would have happened anyway.
Hmm. So four people go, 15% of their salary.
It's a lot.
Is that, yes.
Yes.
And that leaves 32 positions still filled at this organization, which distributes money to participating arts groups. That's what they do. They collect and they hand out. It's like a United Way for the arts. Does the 32, they had 30, what, six positions prior to the layoffs. Does that strike anyone around this table as a lot of positions to hand out money? I mean, I don't know anything about how they operate, but is that, so that sounds like a lot of people.
In addition to doling out the funds, they also hold what are called these culture blocks across the city. So I think part of their attention goes to doling out those funds, but they also need, I guess, the staffing to hold those culture blocks across the city.
Because I was talking to an artist friend of mine. They said they're not 36 artists who get money from the ASC.
Wow.
That's an exaggeration. It's hyperbole. But nonetheless, it seems like a lot of people. Okay, right. So but we don't know if that's the end of it, do we?
We don't.
Okay. No.
The I-77 toll lanes, wow, as of last weekend are now, I think, well, they'll be completely open tomorrow. They're not really completely open yet because they have what? One exit to finish. Mm-hmm. And despite all the opposition we heard about, at least one driver who spoke with WSSC-TV is excited.
That's great. It's fantastic. I mean, all the traffic that we've had around here, it's going to be so much easier.
So is he in the minority?
It used to be you couldn't stand in the parking lot of a Harris Teeter in Huntersville, right, and find one person who had that opinion.
Absolutely. I mean, you just go to a gas station, stop anywhere off North Mecklenburg exits, and yeah, I'm surprised you found that, Joe.
So are people using these lanes now in any great number? Have the lanes being open had any impact on traffic?
Sintra says there's been an impact on traffic, but the fact is a majority of people are still sitting in traffic in mm-hmm. the free lanes. And while the lanes are open, there's still a lot of work that still has to be done.
Absolutely.
With the project. The lanes in the free lanes are a mess right now. There are lines all over the place. The noise barriers haven't been built. There's uneven pavement. So there's still a lot of work that has to be done. And that's why NCDOT is still leveraging these $30,000 fines. And
to go into a little bit.
David Borax is a frequent guest here of WFAE and lives in the north suburbs. And he was very skeptical, and he has started using them. And last night, Mike, you and I were both at an event uptown. David and I left our University City office at the same time. And when I finally pulled in very stressed out, he had taken the toll lanes and he was standing there with a glass of wine in his hand. So it I think it becomes something that when you get that convenience, you start saying, I might pay for that.
It's still a divide.
There's one caveat to that, because if you start, it depends on where you start. And if y'all were coming from university, it's a little bit different if
you're
starting
can't get on, do you hit
North Mecklenburg. Well, so you can take the entire, I took the, just so happened I had a dentist appointment yesterday, so I took it. I live in uptown, and I drove all the way up to Catawba Avenue. What I did not realize, so from Hambright Road north to Mooresville, that's the section that opened or was completed, open to traffic first. Did not realize that they still have paving to do up near Catawba Avenue. And if folks remember, I mean, that seemed to be farther along. I don't know if Joe would agree, but that section seemed to be farther along. And it was just surprising to see that there are large sections where there's, and they're repaving the entire 26-mile
right
express lane project. So you know, you go out there and it just really, you hear one explanation from Centra and NCDOT, and then you go out there and you see something completely different. Like with the noise walls, there's a neighborhood in Genesis Park that is torn to bits. I mean, people's front yard is just a construction site. And I went out there day before yesterday, beautiful day, didn't see anybody working on the noise walls. It's just really hard to figure out. You know, they'll say weather permitting, but you'll see nobody out there working.
And evidently, the uneven pavement around 485 and 77 has caused what, NCDOT to issue a warning to motorcyclists not to use that exit?
Huntersville Fire and Huntersville PD earlier this week sent out warnings. There had been, at that time, 5 incidents or crashes, and motorcycle crashes, at the 485, going from 45 outer to 77 north. It's a huge drop off. Yeah. I was out there, you can see visibly cars jerk. So you can only imagine what it's like if a motorcycle, but one of those was fatal. So
the contractor, I-77 Mobility Partners, is still racking up fines, I think $30,000 a day for missing deadlines, including work on the final toll lane exit that is scheduled to be completed, I believe, this weekend. That amounts so far to, as you reported, Joe, $500,000 as of Monday, on top of about $2.4 million in penalties for previous violations. So aside from that exit lane, what else is incomplete? Just the repaving of the free lanes?
The repaving of the free lanes, noise walls, yes.
How long will that take?
Who knows?
I mean, those noise walls, if you just watch them do that, Mike, it's a very long process. I mean, these huge cement pylons, and then they have to use a crane to lift the actual pieces of the wall in. It's not an easy process.
They've missed 3 deadlines. Who knows what timeline they're working on?
Well, I drove it recently, and it just was very confusing. Maybe that's my driving, but it looked like there was still a lot of construction going on.
Absolutely. I mean, just sections of green space that you would think would be green space that is just a construction site.
We're also finally getting an idea of what it's really going to, because they were very evasive about what it would cost to ride in these lanes. We're finally getting an idea because the signs are lit up now and they tell you things. But beginning on December 1st, the change in pricing will then begin. It will be dependent on the time of day and congestion, because the 25% discount is gone away. So what are people paying, and how the heck does it work? Because I was going north on 77, and it says, toll lanes are now open.
Right.
And then it said like $1.50 or $1.80. How far will that get
you? It's complicated because you have to do math while you're driving. Like, okay, wait, the last toll was $5. Like, this one's $3. So, yeah, it is complicated. And there really isn't an easy way to find out right now how much each section of the toll costs. Hopefully that changes.
And if you want to go the whole 26 miles, or 25 miles, they say the one-hour trip at rush hour will cost you $6.50 in toll. But
so,
if you have a ceiling on what you're willing to pay for this, can you get off at some when you've racked up $3.50 and you think that's enough? Can you get off
at their designated exit points?
Right,
yes.
Right. I mean, have to pay for a certain section, so they're not going to let you off before you've paid for it.
And once you're on, if you enter where it says $1.50, okay, I'm willing to pay $1.50. But then you go a half a mile, and is there another sign that says $2.50?
It is. So the trick is a North Mecklenburg.
It's too late there.
A North
We're
Mecklenburg,
halfway through, and I want to raise. Otherwise, I'm leaving.
I have something for you. So a North Mecklenburg resident who is experienced with the toll lane says it's based. The higher it is when she will use it. So if the price is lower, that means the traffic the free side.
Yeah.
Is
okay.
So you have to, the higher it is, you take the toll lanes, the lower it is, it means that the traffic on it's a game.
So she's already figured out a
system. GPS does this too.
Right.
You know, will GPS route you onto that when traffic's really bad?
Right. Probably. The GPS routes people on the Monroe Expressway.
So if you have 4 passengers in the car, it's not free, right?
It's free if you have the HOV transponder and it's designated as on.
What?
Just make sure. Look, if you need questions, just come pick Joe or I up, and we'll ride with you.
To buy a transponder, and you have to turn it on 15 minutes before you are going to use the lanes.
Uh-huh.
And if you have at least 3 people in your car, the ride will be free.
But you have to remember to switch it on.
How does it know you have three people in the car? Because there are cameras everywhere.
That's Joe right, rests his right. head in his temple.
It really does feel like you need a co-pilot now to drive right. on those Jeez. Lanes.
Okay, Charlotte's presence as a banking center took a hit a couple years back and now appears to be regaining that its importance as a banking city. This week, the merger between Winston-Salem's BB&T and Atlanta-based SunTrust was approved by the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, member FDIC. The new bank, Truist, will be headquartered here. What will this mean for our position as a banking center?
Well, I think we will solidify our spot as number two, perhaps. And? We'll finally push San Francisco aside.
Okay. This is a $66 billion merger, which will have more than $425 billion in assets and be one of the largest retail banks in the South. Put that into perspective.
That's the sixth largest bank in the country, I believe. Wow. It will be with the merger.
And this is scheduled to close on December the 6th. So when will the BB&T and SunTrust signs disappear, being replaced by, stand by, the Truist sign?
I think we'll start to see that transition in the next year.
I think they ought to re-spell their name. It's T-R-U-I-S-T. It ought to be T-R-U-E-S-T, don't you think?
No, but that's the gimmick, Mike. That's the gimmick.
Oh, is this the gimmick?
Yeah.
That's what the consultant
That's
made
branding.
I don't get it. Okay. Well, speaking of names, let me go to page 9. Let me go deeper into this. Yeah. Speaking of, the Charlotte Housing Authority has changed its name to Truist. No. To Inlivian? Is that how you pronounce it?
I believe it is.
I-N-L-I-V-I-A-N. Why?
Well, it was named the Housing Authority when it was created in 1939, you know, Great Depression, and they're saying they've evolved. They're no longer just a traditional housing authority, but an entrepreneurial agency focused on solutions to help address Charlotte's housing challenges. So,
what does that mean? For
it means
an agency
they're rebranding.
To be entrepreneurial.
Well, it means in part that they are no longer just an agency that provides. When you think housing authority, you think projects. Yep. You know, you think a big block of apartments where poor people live, and they are now doing all these mixed use or mixed income developments. They're marketing to a broader segment. So they said they needed a new name. This is not totally unusual. A lot of other cities have done this, but they've come up with names like Fort Worth Housing Solutions, Salt Lake Housing Connect, Portland Home Forward. I mean, things that that sort
it didn't start out that way, but now I do think that the idea of public housing and public housing authorities has a negative connotation for
and
better
they did
or
a
worse.
Study and found out that they yes. found out the word housing and the word authority have negative connotations.
Yes.
Inlivian kind of also fits into this theme of weird apartment names that are just popping up all across the city. Like Inlivian, you might not distinguish from a Gray Star or a Penrose or a 1305 Central. So they all have these kind of funky names. Inlivian sounds like it would fit that mold.
Yeah, I can expect to hear somebody on TV saying, ask your doctor if Inlivian might be right for you.
Well, yes, I was just going to say the TV commercials, if they ever do them, there'll be harp music, ring, soft focus. Inlivian.
Also, I think
you're
they think
it's the voice actor.
They think it sounds like Enliven. You know, your life is going to get, you know,
yeah,
it's going to be.
They literally said that. And they said the residents came up with this, that they looked at more traditional approaches and that residents. So I sort of feel better about that if people who actually live there really wanted this as opposed to some
Charlotte.
Consultant.
Yeah, Charlotte's a fun place to inlive, you know.
Okay. All right. Monday night, the Charlotte City Council approved rezoning for nearly 1,800 acres along the Lynx Blue Line for transit-oriented development. How does this differ from how the land was previously zoned and what it will mean? What will it mean going forward?
I think the connection is affordable housing with as people probably know with the Blue Line, especially the southern section that runs between South End and 45, there are a lot of apartments that were built along the Blue Line, but there are very few, if any, that are affordable units. So the city wanted to make sure going forward with any sort of mass transit that involves light rail.
Which it would include the Silver Line as they plan that.
Any future light rail line includes or it requires developers. You can have, and then it gets into the weeds of height requirements. They're limited on height requirements along the light rail, but they can go higher if they increase the amount of affordable units.
So that's how it differs, because the city has very few tools with which to mandate affordable
initially,
housing.
Initially, yes.
So what they're saying is structures along these rail lines can only be so high, but if you put in affordable housing, you can go 2, 3, 4 stories higher.
Correct.
Which means you can make more money if you're the developer.
Right. Correct.
Well, we always have these stories about our affordable housing crisis, and that's one of Mayor Vilile's signature issues. And yet you go around and you see all these apartments going up. You say, well, how can that be? Well, of course, they're not affordable. They're market rate. Right. And so this is
along the northern
solution.
Section, Mike, so the Blue Line extension that goes, you know, north to UNTC, there are still a lot of apartments, but I do know that those more of those include affordable units on the northern section. So I think this is, like I said, just the city trying to ensure as we get closer to a potential silver line that we don't have the problem that they had with the Blue Line.
And Councilman Braxton Winston said this is a way to correct mistakes in the past for future development. It seems likely, more likely with every passing week, that Charlotte is going to be the home to the 30th Major League Soccer team. As that league expands, and Charlotte City Council has yet to vote on any expansion incentives that will likely be asked for or required, when might they start talking about this?
It looks like now they're going to hold off until the new council, and I think there's a good chance, at least as it's been explained to me, that they'll wait for the MLS to act, and then they will follow up with that.
So these incentives, if and when they come, would they be incentives to encourage MLS to award the team to Charlotte, or incentives for outfitting Bank of America Stadium that MLS might see as an indication of our enthusiasm?
Outfitting the Bank of America Stadium with the middle entrance to the field, camera setups for televising these soccer matches, as well as new locker rooms. But, you know, yesterday the commissioner of MLS announced that the 30th team for Major League Soccer will be announced this year. And the only three cities that he has mentioned, and he's mentioned Charlotte as the front runner, the other two are Phoenix and Las Vegas. And Phoenix and Las Vegas, their bids are just nowhere close to where Charlotte
it's
is.
Coming.
So there's a good bet that he already has his plane ticket to Charlotte at some point in December.
If it doesn't come, I'll eat this desk. City Council voted unanimously on Monday to defer a decision on a townhome project proposed for Bates Ford Road across from Hornets Nest Park, where a developer wants to build 100 homes on what is currently vacant land. So why do they postpone the decision?
What's interesting is there were so many people absent from the meeting. There were only 7 people there. People were sick. People had prearranged trips. So if 2 people were opposed to this project, it basically couldn't pass.
And Justin Harlow, city councilman who represents that area, has called this proposal half-baked, but he's changed his mind since then. And it's also been described as a controversial project. Why did he change his mind? Why was it controversial? And you have 28 seconds.
Because the developer has been working with the neighbors to bring changes, make the development more appeasing to the community, and he feels the developer has met those standards.
Mayor Lyles goes to Washington. News from the foundation of the Carolinas that they dispute. And Governor Cooper has a pipeline. Well, maybe not. We'll talk about all those and much more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here. She's our education reporter at WFAE News, among other things. Joe Bruno joins us from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist and a contributor, a columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB-TV
yeah.
News Rising, and Jonathan Lowe's an anchor reporter for Spectrum News. Jonathan, we're several weeks beyond the most recent local elections, but evidently there's some question about what happened in the Waxhaw mayor's race. We don't often talk about Waxhaw, so let's talk about them. A hand recount is looming. Why?
So, actually, they held the recount on Tuesday for the mayoral race. It was because initially after the November general election, the November 5th election, the top vote getter, Ron Pappas, was within, there were 7 votes separating him and John Perdue. So they did on Tuesday a hand-eye recount of 2,000 ballots, something I've never seen before.
What does that mean, hand-eye?
So whenever the vote is less than 1%, it forces a mandatory recount.
Okay.
The runner-up can choose the format. So you can do a machine recount.
Yeah.
You can do a hand-eye recount, which means 2 teams. It's very old-fashioned, but there were 2 teams of 4.
It's like the Chad thing. They were looking for Chads, right?
Kind of.
Okay.
So 2 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and you literally have all of the ballots that you pull out of the boxes, and the person goes, Perdue.
Oh, my goodness.
Perdue.
Bless their hearts.
Perdue.
2,000 ballots.
Perdue. And one person, and they're doing a tally. Oh, remember a tally from
Wow.
One stick, pick up sticks or whatever.
One, two, three, four, cross legs.
Correct.
Okay.
So, so they went through that. It took about an hour and a half for them to get all the way through that.
And the winner is?
And at the end, Ron Pappas was maintained his lead, but they were off by one after. So vote margin was six.
So how do they normally count the votes? By machine?
It's up to
and the machine
the
made a mistake?
No, it was just the vote was so close, they had to recount it. There was less than 1%.
I understand that.
The margin.
But you just told me that the count was off by one.
Good question.
Machine?
From November 5th, it was off by one.
So the machine made a mistake?
Apparently.
How?
Well, I wonder if it was an absentee ballot. Maybe it read the incorrect bubble hand.
Yeah. Oh, that was what bubble. It... Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Well, that explains that. That clears that.
Thank you, Joe.
We've been talking for several weeks about the Silver Line rail route and City Council appropriating $50 million to conduct a study, to study which route it would take, which would tell them how much it might cost to build this thing. And there was some question about whether we should spend the $50 million when we don't even know if we have enough money to build it once the $50 million says what it will cost. So this week, Mayor Lyles went to Washington. She appeared before the House Subcommittee on Energy and Climate Change and talked about the city's efforts to reduce carbon emissions. But she also said we need more money. For what?
Mass transit.
Exactly.
What do you think?
One of my favorite quotes from her was she said if she could wave a magic wand, she would have less cars in Charlotte.
Yeah.
Basically, she also talked about the work that the city of Charlotte is doing to combat climate change. She said that she referenced this, that there's so much construction and so many cars in Charlotte in the summer that asthma is really bad. And she referenced code oranges that have had to been put out there where seniors can't leave their homes.
So
don't they also have like a 2030 goal to get to zero carbon for vehicles?
Zero
so
carbon
she talked
sources.
About the need for retrofitting existing facilities, for electric vehicles, for infrastructure money to make choices that will make a difference, and more money for mass transit and light rail. Any chance we'll get any of this money?
We'll see.
We'll see. That $50 million, starts a process of designing it, and they can't know if they will get any federal funding until they start that process.
The Charlotte Observer published details of an investigation they have undertaken that has revealed that more than $20 million managed by the Foundation for the Carolinas has bankrolled anti-immigration organizations in the United States, including the Center for Immigration Studies and Federation for American Immigration Reform, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has deemed to be hate groups. What brought on the investigation by the Observer?
This is something that has kept coming up over the years. Different national outlets look into this, and so WFAE has reported it. Other media have reported it. Probably the Observer started looking into this after one of them. And then there was a sludge report that came out almost at the same time as the Observer's. But the Observer did a good deep dive on this.
Yeah.
And it is not the Foundation for the Carolinas as an entity voting to say, let's support this group. These are what they call their donor-advised funds. So
Correct.
You've got a rich guy, and we don't know for sure who it is because they don't have to disclose this, but we have a pretty good idea.
So as you point out, it is not the Foundation for the Carolinas policy to donate to these groups. It is their donors who say, I want my money to go to X. And then they do that. And the only policy that I understand the Foundation for the Carolinas has on any of this is they only allow donations to be designated to organizations that are recognized by the IRS as being nonprofits. Do these two organizations, are they recognized by the IRS as being nonprofits?
Yes, they are.
Okay. So the Foundation would not comment to the Observer about the donor who directed those contributions. And CEO Michael Marsicano told the newspaper that the Foundation is reluctant to tell its donors where their money can't go, characterizing donations as a form of free speech. But he also took issue with the reporting itself during an interview with WFAE.
We believe that community foundations are big tents where donors from all different stripes and shapes and sizes and colors are going to fund different organizations with different purposes across the political spectrum, the social spectrum, and the religious spectrum.
So some may not like these two organizations, but isn't it the right of anybody who has money to give it to anybody or anything they want to give it to? That is free speech, right?
I think it's what makes this a really interesting question, because I do think when you have a group that is being labeled as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, you have to kind of raise your eyebrow. But it does raise the question that if the foundation were to start saying no to this one that's objectionable to this group, well, how many other
right.
donor-founded groups might be objectionable?
Mary.
And you have to recognize that this issue, it revolves around such an issue that's in this partisan time so divisive, which is immigration. And when you look at what these groups are doing, some of them are lobbying for an end to birthright citizenship, building a wall, limiting immigration by poor immigrants. It is going to, of course, cause a big discussion because these are sort of the big issues of our time. It's so partisan. It is so divisive. So you're going to have this discussion.
Right. And as you say, if they prohibit giving to those groups, which are deemed to be hate groups, there are people on the other side who will say, no, you can't give your money to Planned Parenthood. So,
although I do think it was interesting, the Observer also reported that you had groups like Leading on Opportunity, which is very closely tied to the foundation, the Carolinas, that had gone to them and said, please stop channeling money to this group. This goes so counter to everything we're trying to do in terms of creating a more unified community, creating more opportunity, and your name is now being attached to something that is destructive to that.
So more trouble in Raleigh this week surrounding the Atlantic Coast Natural Gas Pipeline. A report authorized by a Republican-controlled legislative committee has found that Governor Cooper appears to have improperly used the authority and influence of his office, their words, to pressure the builders to be part of a $57.8 million mitigation fund under his control. But, of course, Governor Cooper insists the facts are on his side.
For almost 2 years, this has been a partisan political circus, and it is still a partisan political circus.
So this mitigation fund, are they saying that he's pressuring the builders to contribute to or be part of this mitigation fund, and the mitigation fund would be for what? Is that what they're saying, by the way?
Well, Republican lawmakers have accused the mitigation fund of being a slush fund, essentially, for Governor Cooper.
Okay.
The report essentially found that Governor Cooper didn't benefit from the pipeline actions, but there may have been improper influence. And one thing that I did find interesting is that the report wasn't designed to find criminal violations, but throughout the reporting process, they discover that that may have occurred.
And you know that the lieutenant governor now calling for the FBI to investigate the governor.
Is there any objective truth here?
Well, you know, I think a criminal investigation would show that. This has always had kind of a funny smell to it because it was something where he came out and said, there's this fund, it's going to be from the people who are building this pipeline, and it's going to be available for environmental mitigation, renewable energy, economic development for the counties where this pipeline is going through. By the way, that money's going to come through my office. And I think that was one of the reasons that the legislature, you know, raised flags and essentially grabbed the money back and said, no, we're going to use that money and give it to school districts in those counties. So it's been a controversial move.
The lieutenant governor saying that the governor's top aide claims the creation of the fund was Duke Energy's idea and Duke Energy states otherwise. Someone is lying, and that's a quote from Lieutenant Governor.
So. Okay, this week David Tepper came out with a new word we should be afraid of, very afraid, mediocrity. He said he doesn't like mediocrity, and he's known for being candid. And these are very candid remarks, which I must have sent shivers through many of the people within the Panthers organization, because we are having a mediocre season, and the history of the Panthers has been on again, off again. He mentioned that he never accepted losing on the business side, and every time the team loses, his mood resembles an expletive. He said he didn't sleep well after last weekend's loss to Atlanta, and that long-term mediocrity would not be accepted. So after those remarks, is the coaching staff sleeping well?
I don't know if anybody would be sleeping well. I mean, I went to the game, Mike, and it was bad.
I saw it.
It was bad.
Some of us can't afford tickets, Jonathan, but you're on television.
Yeah. What did Olson? Greg Olson called it a comedy of terrible.
I mean, it was really bad, and David Tepper looks like the kind of guy is like, you know, yeah, I have a lot of money, but I'm not about to come up in here and spend a whole bunch of money and have a team that's not, you know, that plays that bad.
And Ron Rivera came back and said, look, I get that. I don't like mediocrity either. I essentially said he knows his job is on the line.
And look at who we lost to. I mean, they had to win that game. And Atlanta was 2-7.
In the division, yeah.
So everybody, I think fans, that was why it was so crowded. The weather was great. And everybody came in there thinking that the Panthers, we were going to win.
And he mentioned that they were leaving early.
So Tepper also spoke about Major League Soccer, and he said that the stadium will need specific updates to support soccer teams, including outfitting for soccer camera angles. They have to redesign the thing. But he didn't say how much he would be prepared to pay to bring that team here. It's rumored it's going to be in the neighborhood of $300 million. Did he shed any new details on that would add to what we already know?
Not a whole lot. He basically said one of the reasons why he wants MLS, though, is because he thinks Charlotte will never have a Major League Baseball team, and he thinks MLS will be able to fill that gap in the summer. And I thought it was interesting. He mentioned how he brought Honeywell's CEO to a meeting with Major League Soccer to demonstrate how much corporate support there is for this team in Charlotte.
Okay. The legislature has completed their redraw of congressional districts, but now there's a lawsuit by Democrats challenging the redraw, and now the courts have gotten involved and said, you cannot register candidates until we decide, and they haven't made a decision.
Ah, yes. Welcome to another episode of North Carolina Redistricting. The state is split about 50-50, but the Republicans had a 10-3 advantage in the U.S. House district, and now they've come up with a plan that makes the split 8-5. But folks are saying, you know, Democrats and others are saying, it's still partisan gerrymandering. Sure, you've put Asheville together again, but it's partisan. Why aren't they more swing districts and competitive districts? So the courts, we're running against the time where people have to file.
And because
so they need to know.
Because the Supreme Court has opted out of talking about political gerrymandering.
Yes.
The court's decision here, could it have greater impact than it normally would?
Oh, yeah. You'll see people are looking at this as a blueprint, other states, on seeing how they can do this. But right now, people are stuck because they don't know where they're going to file. And then we have the primary coming up on March 3rd. so, yes, the court's going to, December 2nd, say something about
it. There was another Democratic debate this week. Maybe you watched it. Maybe you didn't. I think 10 candidates were up on the stage in Atlanta with big news prior to the debate. Newcomer Michael Bloomberg, former New York mayor, entered the race almost immediately, had to apologize for his stop and frisk policy. He joined other Democrats who are apologizing left and right, like Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. You wrote an opinion column about that in which it was headlined, "Should Black Voters Listen, Forgive, and Vote?" What conclusion did you reach, Mary?
I'm just saying on the criminal justice side, they want something. They want more. You know, we're living in a year where a couple of black people have been killed by police in their own homes and apartments. Yes, the black voters care about many issues, health care, you know, the economy and so forth, but they really want to have a commitment from the party because they're the base. You cannot win without black and brown voters and being enthusiastic. So they are being very strategic. They are listening. To be continued.
Can Michael Bloomberg get past that?
I don't think
no,
so, Mike. I heard a soundbite earlier this year where he had said that he supported stop
yes,
and frisk.
No, he can't.
Well, this week the city lost a very important person with a powerful voice. Dr. Susan Cherniak-Spatz died at the age of 97. She was a Holocaust survivor and used that unspeakable period of her life to educate and warn others about the slippery slope to extremism that is almost always present. She helped start the Holocaust Studies program at UNC Charlotte and several years ago wrote a remarkably forthcoming book about her experiences as Hitler's hatred built in the Berlin in which she used to live and what happened to her in the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau and at two others. Protective Custody, Prisoner 34042. Was her memoir that detailed her early life and what it took to survive. And we spoke to her about this several years ago on this program.
You had to make up your mind very quickly. Did you want to live or did you want to die?
Mm-hmm.
It was a very conscious decision. Because if you wanted to give in, dying was no art in Birkenau. Absolutely no art.
Easy to do.
Living was a heroism.
Every encounter that I ever had with Dr. Spatz reinforced the strength that she mustered to survive. She was a force to be reckoned with who did not suffer fools, and she didn't have to. She had every right not to. You can hear that memorable conversation on our website at WFAE.org, or you can hear it on this program on Monday. Dr. Susan Cherniak-Spatz, what a woman. Ann Doss Helms, Joe Bruno, Mary C. Curtis, Jonathan Lowe from WFAE, WSOC, Roll Call, WCCB-TV, and Spectrum News. Got them all in there. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.